Give me a break. He was lying his ass off.
For what reason? Asked Roby.
Spy's a lie, and he's probably covering his butt on the waterboarding thing.
Did he need to? It's not like we belong to a union and can file a grievance. Footsteps sounded again, and each of them instinctively gripped a knife next to their plates. However, it was merely the orderly retrieving the table. Another escort was with him. He led them to the showers, where they cleaned up and changed into fresh clothes. As they were walked back to their room, Real whispered into Roby's ear.
This is freaking me out more than the waterboarding. Why are they being nice to us?
Roby whispered back. Maybe Tucker gave the word.
Like I believe that.
4 hours passed before someone came for them again. They were told to change into running gear. Then they were taken by jeep to a remote part of the facility deep within the forest and dropped off. The weather wasn't bad. In the 40s, a little overcast, but the sun was high in the sky and warming. Roby calculated it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. After the vehicle drove off, someone stepped onto the path from behind some trees. They turned to see who it was. Amanda Marks stood there wearing a running suit and Nikes.
I trust you're well fed and rested,
she said.
And clean,
said Real.
Let's not forget that. Then let's take a run, shall we?
Without waiting for their answer, Marks turned and jogged off. Roby and Real glanced confusedly at one another before joining her. He on the right, she on the left.
So did you know Tucker was coming down today?
Asked Real.
At the last minute. What did he want to talk to you about?
You mean he didn't tell you? Asked Roby.
If he had, I wouldn't be asking you.
He wanted to let us know our being here was not part of a personal vendetta. He said we were waterboarded not in order to facilitate a confession because there was no such thing, but rather to make sure we could withstand it in case we were captured.
And did you believe him?
Asked Marks.
Would you?
Real shot back.
I don't know. I really don't. He's a more complicated person than I initially thought. I don't trust him,
said Real.
If I were in your position, I wouldn't trust him either,
replied Marks. Real said,
I take it the food and rest and showers were your doing? Well, they certainly weren't the DCI's or Andrew Viola's initiative. Viola,
said a surprised Real.
He's involved in this? I thought you would have recognized his voice at the little waterboarding session. You two overlapped here, right? And I know you were in the field with him on a couple of missions. That's right, but I didn't recognize the voice. Probably had your mind on other things,
said Marks dryly. She looked at Roby.
Do you know Viola?
Only by reputation. He's really good.
Rock-solid warrior who never wavers from the playbook,
replied Marks. Real and Roby exchanged a quick glance. Real said,
Is that why we're out here jogging in the middle of the forest? So we can talk candidly? Let me put it this way. I already ran 10 miles this morning, so from a physical fitness point of view, there's no reason for me to be out here.
So Viola is a team player, said Roby.
And you are not,
added Real.
Didn't say that,
replied Marks.
I am a team player. And the little near-drowning session last night?
Noted Real.
Not my call, and I wasn't picked to run it. That's where Viola stepped in. Surprised I hadn't seen him at the facility before,
said Real inquiringly.
He was just called back in from temp duty elsewhere,
answered Marks. By Evan Tucker? Asked Roby, swinging his arms loosely and popping his neck as they ran along at a comfortable pace.
Don't know for sure, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. Viola is a high-level asset. He wouldn't be called in by a mid-level grunt, and I certainly didn't do it as the DD.
So why didn't Tucker rely on you to do the dirty work? Roby wanted to know. Real added,
Did you refuse to waterboard us?
Marks ran along for another 30 feet before answering.
He never asked me to. And if he had?
Real persisted.
What would you have done? I never agreed with torturing bad guys, much less our own agents.
Well, undoubtedly, Tucker was aware of that, said Roby. And didn't bother to ask you to do it. Obviously, Viola had no issue with doing it.
No, he didn't. He would never decline to execute a direct order. He's not wired that way. But how could Tucker ever expect us to sign a confession?
Said Real.
Even if we were tortured.
He's not really CIA, answered Roby. He was never in the intelligence field. His appointment to head up CIA was a political payback. He probably thought waterboarding works on everyone.
As if a coerced confession is valid,
noted Real.
And he wanted us to sign it despite the bullshit he tried to feed us back there. I don't think he was going to use it in a court of law,
said Marks. Real shot her a glance.
What then?
Roby answered. Probably proof to the president that we were bad guys. Marks added,
And maybe the president signs off on your official termination, not the kind where you clear out your desk and are escorted to the exit. If Tucker thought that was going to happen, and he's running CIA, America is in a world of trouble,
observed Real. I don't know, said Roby. Maybe he just wanted to kill us.
He might just want us to feel the pain,
said Real. Mission accomplished there, said Roby. Real stopped running, and the others pulled up and looked at her.
Which brings us back to the question of why you're doing what you're doing, Deputy Director,
she said. Marks jogged in place, keeping her body warm and loose.
I'm a team player, Real. Make no mistake about that. But I draw the line at certain things. Waterboarding our own is one of those things. Anything else? Tucker said he wanted me to push you right to your limit and then beyond. He really wanted to see if you were fit for duty and redeployment. Either you could cut it or not. I assumed that was his goal, to find that out. And now? And now I don't know. His instructions had undertones that maybe he didn't want you to see the outside of this place again. And you chose to what, ignore them?
Said Real.
I chose to think he couldn't mean that,
said Marks. Or convinced yourself that he couldn't, said Roby. Mark started to run again, and the pair followed her.
So where does all this leave us?
Asked Real.
I don't know,
admitted Marks.
But I can tell you that from now on I will train with you.
Why? Asked Roby.
To be our guardian?
Suggested Real.
I'm just going to train with you.
This is not your problem or your fight, D.D., said Roby. Don't hang your career on this. You don't deserve the possible fallout.
I'm the D.D., as you pointed out, Roby, and the D.D. is responsible for her assets in the field. Well, you two are part of those assets, and it's my responsibility to look out for you. So you're setting yourself up for a pissing contest with Evan Tucker over this?
Exclaimed Real.
Number one against two has a predetermined outcome. Maybe,
replied Marks cryptically.
But then number twos tend to try harder.
Real said,
You looking to make an enemy of Tucker? I'm not intentionally making an enemy of anyone. What I'm trying to do is my job.
I thought your job was to follow orders, said Roby.
My job is to perform my duties as a DD to the best of my abilities. I intend to do just that.
She picked up her pace, leaving the pair of them behind by about 10 yards. This seemed to be intentional to allow them to discuss what she had just said.
You think she's on the up and up, or is she pretending to be our friend for some ulterior reason?
Said Real. I don't know. She seems sincere. And why the need to be our friend? She's got us here. She can do what she wants with us.
And it's not like she asked us to do anything,
said Real thoughtfully. Not yet, corrected Roby.
So what do we do?
We let it play out. I think that's all we can do.
And if she is on the up and up?
Then I hope she doesn't end up being collateral damage. Because I don't think Evan Tucker cares who gets in the way or who gets hurt. Real slowed down and then stopped. He came back to her. What is it?
Roby, I'm putting everyone in danger. You, her, Julie, anyone associated with me.
Don't be stupid.
You just said it. Anyone who gets in his way to get to me. Because let's face it, I'm the one he really wants.
So what?
So I need to go this alone, Roby.
Go it alone? Against the CIA?
I'm not putting you or anyone else in danger. Any more danger. I've nearly gotten you killed more times than I can count.
Do you remember what I told you while we were standing in the rain, Jessica?
I know that, but...
I've never said that to anyone else. Ever. At his words, Real's eyes glimmered, and she seemed taken aback, but quickly regrouped.
But this is not survivable, Roby. They waterboarded us last night. What next, a firing squad?
Whatever it is, we'll take it on together. That way we double our chances of survival.
No, we just double the potential number of casualties.
Let's go. Marx gets too far ahead, she might hold back dessert tonight as punishment. Roby ran off. Real waited a few more seconds, and then shook her head and ran hard to catch up. But the worried look in her eyes remained. Chapter 17.
Mr. Fontaine?
Earl, who had been dozing in his prison hospital bed, roused, opened his eyes, and looked around.
Mr. Fontaine?
He focused on her, the young doctor. He sat up straighter. Yeah, Doc? She pulled up a chair and sat next to him. Earl noted that a guard other than Big Albert was with her, but the man was still keenly watching Earl. He probably knew Earl's crimes even if the young doctor didn't.
I wanted to let you know that I made some calls.
Calls?
About your request.
Earl knew what she was talking about, but he had decided to play to the hilt the doddering old man with not much time to live. About my little girl, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Sweet Jesus, thank you so much, Doc.
I spoke to some people up in Washington.
Washington, holy Lord, thank you, thank you.
They put me in contact with other people after I explained the situation. Now, there are no guarantees.
Course not, Doc, never expected none, but what you did, well, I don't know enough words to properly thank you. It just means the world to me.
The doctor seemed embarrassed by this outpouring of gratitude. Her cheeks tinged with red. She continued.
These matters are very delicate, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Earl hastily said, Oh, course I understand. All hush-hush, you mean.
Yes. Now, this isn't exactly my field of expertise, but I explained the situation as best I could. The U.S. Marshals...
The Marshals! Lordy, lordy! Exclaimed Earl. My little girl is okay, ain't she?
The Marshals oversee the Witness Protection Program, Mr. Fontaine.
Oh, hell, that's right. He pointed to his IV lines. These drugs, Doc, these dang drugs mess up my head, can't think straight. Half the time, ain't even know my own name.
I'm sure,
she said, giving him a sympathetic smile. Then she hurried on.
They said that the request was very unusual and that they would have to check it out. I'm not sure how long it will take, but I did tell them of your personal circumstances, that is...
Here she faltered. Meaning I ain't got much longer to live, Earl said helpfully.
Yes, I told them that. I didn't go into specifics because that would be a violation of patient confidentiality.
Course, course, said Earl encouragingly. Hell, glad you did it. Not like I care, who knows. Dying is dying.
But they said if it proved legitimate, they would take steps to contact your daughter and at least put her in possession of the facts.
A damn dream come true, and I say that right from here, said Earl, with tears sliding down his cheeks as he touched his chest.
Now, Mr. Fontaine, please understand, simply because they might reach out to her in no way assures that she will accept your offer to come and visit.
Hell, I know that, Doc, but at least she'll know she has a choice, right? More than I had before. He put out a shaky hand for her to take. I ain't know how to thank you properly, Doc. I just hoping it's your time to go, you remember back to this here moment, to how you made an old man happier than he's been in a long, long time.
The doctor took his hand and shook it lightly, while the guard hovered nearby, rolling his eyes.
After she moved off, Earl lay back on his bed. He could feel his heart beating madly. He breathed deeply, calming his weak chest. Can't die now, old man. Gotta keep going. Got to keep going. He looked over at Junior, who was staring at him from his bed. There was something in the other man's look that Earl did not care for.
Something on your mind, Junior? Said Earl. What you got going on, old man? said Junior. Anything I got going on ain't any of your damn business now, is it?
Junior eyed Earl with a smile.
No, you, Earl. I'm a damn killer. Kill bitches all over Alabama. Can't help myself. Just got to do it.
He tapped his head.
Up here. Wired funny, doctors say. Not that the damn jury gave a crap about that. Only thing funny about you, Junior, is your face, like a hog's backside. That's why you had to cut them gals at. They ain't screwing somebody ugly as you without a knife to their throat.
Junior did not appear to have heard him.
But you, Earl, now you are one sick son of a bitch. You are an evil prick, and you got something cooking. I can smell it. What I smell is a pile of crap, and it's coming from your damn bed. You shit your sheet again like a damn baby?
But Earl's heart wasn't in his zingers back at Junior. He didn't like it that Junior was suspecting something. What if he told somebody? Made up shit. What would it do to his plan?
I can smell it, old man, Junior persisted.
He smiled menacingly.
And I ain't got nothing else to do except think on it. Maybe I figure it out. And if I do, maybe I tell somebody like the doc. And maybe they ain't gonna execute your ass, Junior. But I wouldn't bet the farm on it.
He looked away from Junior and hollered for the nurse. When she came over, he said in a low voice,
I got me a phone call to make. You set that up for me, honey?
Who are you calling?
Earl glanced over at Junior, whose eyes were once more closed. Some friends of mine, feeling lonely. They say I get one call a day. Ain't had none in 4 days. Can you do it for me, sugar?
I'll see what I can do.
Earl smiled at her and said, Now I'll be right here when you get back.
She snorted at his quip and moved off. The smile faded from Earl's lips. He looked back over at Junior. Not good. Not good at all.
Chapter 18. I need to know unequivocally where you stand. Evan Tucker stared across the width of a conference room table at the man sitting there. If Andrew Viola was surprised by the question, he didn't show it.
I stand where you want me to, sir, replied Viola evenly.
Words, Viola, are easy.
I think I've done more than words, sir. I carried out your orders to the letter.
No confession, though.
We did 3 sessions on them, sir, 1 more and maybe they're dead. Didn't think you wanted it to go down like that, and they're tough, you have to give them that.
I don't give them anything particularly real.
I understand you visited the burner.
I did. I spoke to Roby and Real.
And did it go according to your plan?
Exactly what plan is that? Asked Tucker suspiciously.
I meant did you accomplish your goal, whatever that is.
I told them I needed their assurance that they were totally committed to this mission. I told them the waterboarding was to see if they could withstand such torture if captured.
Okay, said Viola evenly.
And I was speaking the truth, if you care to know.
I never assumed otherwise, sir. The fact is they are the best we have in the field right now, and this mission needs them. I don't necessarily like it, but I have to put my personal feelings aside for the greater good.
I understand.
Tucker drummed his fingers on the table.
Marx has been a disappointment.
She's a first-rate agent, said Viola. Can't say anything against her.
Tucker looked keenly at Viola.
If you play your cards right, you might find yourself as D.D.
Viola looked uncomfortable with this.
With all due respect, Director, I'm not sure I'm cut out for that. I'm a tactical field guy, always have been. Politics and long-term strategies are not my strength.
A man who knows his weaknesses can turn them into strengths.
We might want to see how this plays out, sir.
Tucker nodded.
The mission they're being vetted for is the most important in the last 50 years, perhaps the most important of all time for us.
Viola leaned back in his chair, his eyes widening slightly at this comment, but his features also holding some skepticism. Tucker must have noted this because he said, "Not an exaggeration, Viola, not at all." Viola said nothing.
"Do you think they'll make it through?"
asked Tucker.
"I wouldn't bet against them. Like you said, they're the best we have right now."
"Inability, not loyalty. And I need both."
Viola shifted uncomfortably in his seat. "I never knew what the bad blood was between you and Real, sir."
"There's no need for you to know," said Tucker. "Suffice it to say that Real did something extraordinarily heinous."
Viola looked thoughtful.
"I guess it must be pretty bad if you want her dead."
"I never said I wanted her dead," snapped Tucker.
"Sorry, sir. I just assumed something, I guess. I shouldn't have." Tucker sat back and steepled his hands.
"I just need to know, Viola, that I have their loyalty and they are up to snuff. Do you understand?"
"The up to snuff part I can control easily enough. Loyalty is more part of the brain, sir. The psychs need to get there."
"They are. They will."
"So, what exactly do you want me to do?"
"Your job. Nothing more, nothing less. Have you spoken to Marx?"
"Only enough to get filled in on certain things."
"I want you to watch her as carefully as you're watching Roby and Real."
"What exactly am I looking for?"
"Loyalty, Viola. I demand it from everyone at this agency."
"So you want me to spy on the DD?" Viola said incredulously.
"Just keep in mind that while she's the DD, I'm the DCI. The last time I looked at the organizational chart, I'm above her."
Viola shifted again in his seat.
"No doubt about that."
"Then do what I say. Regular reports. That'll be all."
Viola rose and turned to the door. He turned back to look at Tucker.
"Yes," said Tucker expectantly, though something in his tone seemed to be bracing for a fight.
"I joined CIA to serve my country, Director."
"As did I. Your point?"
"No point, sir. I just wanted to make sure you understood that."
After Viola left, Tucker continued to sit in his seat. He stared at his hands that were dotted with sunspots, the result of too much time sailing the Chesapeake Bay on hot summer days. That was all before he became DCI. Now there was no time for sailing. There was only time for this. It was consuming his life. No, he had no more life. He was the DCI. That was his life. That was his identity now. But his dilemma was fairly obvious. Who could he trust? Marx? Viola? Any of his people? He had the most important mission of his career coming up, perhaps the most important mission the agency had had in decades. And he had told the President of the United States that he had it covered, that his team was being vetted, and if they weren't ready to go, he had another team ready to step in. But did he? He knew what he wanted. He wanted Real to pay for what she had done. And if Roby stood with her, he would get the same treatment. But the fact was he needed them to perform this mission. He had to send the best. And they were the best, by a wide margin. He put his face in his hands. His stomach was full of cold dread. His skin was wet with sweat. He felt nauseated. He felt dead. "Am I suicidal? Has it come to this? Am I really losing it?" The DCI needed to be at the top of his game, right this very minute. He rocked back and forth with his head bracketed by his hands. And then with a spark of clarity, his reason cleared. He lifted his face from his hands. He had his answer. In fact, it had been staring him in the face the whole time. Andrew Viola drove to a private airport to hop on agency wings on the way back to the burner. But he made one stop along the way. He had a phone call that he needed to make, and he didn't trust his secure mobile phone to make it without someone listening in. He stopped at a 24-hour convenience store and stepped out of his car. He didn't go inside. He went to the single payphone that was affixed to the exterior wall. He didn't even know if it would work. He dropped in his change and got a dial tone. He punched in the number, and the phone rang 3 times before it was answered. Blue Man said, "Hello?" Andrew Viola said in a low voice, "You need to hear something. But you didn't hear it from me." "Is this about Roby and Real?" asked Blue Man. "Yes, it is," replied Viola. Viola said his piece and then took some questions from Blue Man, whose real name was Roger Walton. He was very high up at the agency, though not as high up as Amanda Marks and Evan Tucker. He was also a friend and ally of Will Roby's, and of Jessica Reels. When Viola finished, he hung up the payphone and got back into his car. Ironically, the old-fashioned payphone might be the safest form of communication there was these days. NSA tended to focus more on mobile phone traffic and texts and emails. There were so few coin phones left that no one really bothered to monitor them anymore. He started the engine and headed off. He would be back at the burner in a few hours.
And maybe he had just realized that the world was not simply black and white, no matter how much he wanted it to be.
Chapter 19 Spitzer and Bitterman were playing tag team. Seated across from them were Roby and Real.
"Long time no see,"
began Real.
"Lost the love?"
The two psychologists glanced at one another, looking a bit uneasy. Spitzer said,
"We don't make our own appointments."
Roby said, "I know. You follow orders like everybody else."
"So why the double team today?"
said Real. She gave an anxious sideways glance at Roby.
"I thought these sessions were supposed to be one-on-one."
"They usually are," replied Bitterman. "But not today. Does this make you uncomfortable?"
"No,"
said Real.
"I love revealing my innermost thoughts on a public stage."
Spitzer smiled.
"It's not the preferred way, Agent Real, but it might actually be beneficial to you and to Agent Roby." "I can't possibly see how, but I'm not a shrink."
She sat back against the chair, her eyes half closed.
"And at least while we're in here, no one is trying to kill us."
Bitterman said, "You mean kill you when you're in the field?" Roby said, "No, she meant kill us while we're here at the burner."
"It's definitely not a walk in the park here,"
noted Spitzer, as she doodled with her pen on the pad she held. Real said,
"Oh, the training part we can handle. It's the waterboarding in the middle of the night that gets me a little uptight. I like a full 6 hours of sleep, uninterrupted by torture, just like the next person."
Spitzer and Bitterman both gazed at her open-mouthed. Bitterman said, "Are you saying that you were tortured? Here?"
"Don't get your boxers in a wad, Doc,"
said Real.
"It wasn't the first time, and I doubt it will be the last. It's just usually not our own people that do it to us."
Spitzer said,
"But that's illegal."
"Yes, it is," replied Roby. "But please don't think of filing any paperwork on it." "Why?" asked Bitterman. Roby stared at him. "You're a bright guy. I think you can see the end game on that one." Bitterman paled and glanced nervously at Spitzer, who kept her gaze squarely on Real. Bitterman said, "Well, perhaps we should go ahead with our session."
"Perhaps we should,"
said Real.
"So fire away."
The two psychologists readied their notes, and Spitzer spoke first.
"The last time we talked, we were discussing roles. Judge, jury, executioner,"
said Real promptly, while Roby looked on curiously.
"Yes. What role do you feel you're playing right now? Victim?"
"And how does that make you feel?" asked Bitterman.
"Shitty."
He next looked at Roby. "And you?" "Not a victim. A scapegoat. And pissed in case you were going to ask how I felt about it." "So you consider all of this unfair?" asked Bitterman. "I've served my country, risked my life for many years.
I've certainly earned more respect than I'm getting now, so is Real.
But you understand why the circumstances have changed?
Asked Spitzer. Because two traitors are dead? Said Roby. No, I really don't. She wasn't ordered to kill them, pointed out Bitterman. So she took a shortcut. The orders would have been coming, believe me. No, they would have been tried and perhaps convicted, said Bitterman. Just as spies and traitors have been before. Roby shook his head. Do you know what those two were involved in? What they were planning?
It wasn't selling secrets.
Real added, as the two psychologists shook their heads.
It was something that the world could never know about, said Roby. There would never have been a trial. Never. And they would never have gone to prison.
They would have been executed and gone into a grave,
said Real.
And that's where I sent them.
Be that as it may, said Bitterman. There is the issue of following orders and not acting unilaterally.
Otherwise, there is chaos,
added Spitzer. The slippery slope, said Bitterman. I know you can see the implications.
This was a special case,
retorted Real.
Exceptions not only disprove the rule, they destroy it,
replied Spitzer.
Our job is to psychologically vet both of you. While I know that you have been physically challenged while here and will continue to be, we are focused not on your bodies, but on your minds. Do you still have the mental discipline and brain wiring to do your job in the field?
Or will you create a new mission on your own instead of following orders? Added Bitterman. We improvise all the time in the field, protested Roby. I'm not talking about improvisation, said Bitterman. All good field agents do that. I'm talking about going off-grid, going rogue, and creating entirely new missions to counter perceived wrongs. Do you still have the wherewithal to follow only the orders given to you? Real was about to say something and then stopped. Roby, for the first time, looked unsure. Neither of the psychologists said anything. They just stared at the other two, awaiting an answer from one of them.
I don't know,
said Real at last. Roby said nothing. Both Bitterman and Spitzer wrote down some notes. Roby said, So if we can't say that unequivocally, then what? Unfit for deployment? Spitzer looked up.
That's not for us to decide. We simply make recommendations. And what would your recommendation be right now?
Asked Real. Spitzer glanced at Bitterman, who said,
An answer now would be meaningless. Why?
Said Real.
We've been here a while. It's not like they're going to give us a year to figure this out, not if we're being vetted for a mission.
My answer is still the same, replied Bitterman. And Spitzer nodded. Spitzer said,
Do you even want to be redeployed?
She looked from Real to Roby for an answer. Real said,
This job has been my whole life.
That's not an answer, pointed out Bitterman.
It's the only one I've got right now,
replied Real firmly. Roby said, How long do we have? Spitzer said,
We're not the ones to take that up with. Try D.D. Marks. Do you report to her or Evan Tucker?
Asked Real.
The chain of command is clearly defined,
said Spitzer.
But eventually, all things make their way to the DCI, particularly something like this.
Roby nodded. Are we done here?
Do you want to be done?
Asked Spitzer with a knowing look. She was clearly not simply referring to this meeting. Neither Roby nor Real answered. Chapter 20 It was an obstacle course laden with things that could actually kill you. The burner box didn't do things halfway. The only difference now was Amanda Marks was right there with them as they hung from a metal line 100 feet up and made their way slowly over a swamp that had the reputation of being infested with water moccasins, because it was. None of them looked down, because what would have been the point? They reached the other side, found their cache of weapons, and kept moving. Marks pointed ahead and motioned Real to her right, and Roby to her left. The incoming fire started 30 seconds later. It was live ammo. In Real's and Roby's world,
There always came a time when there was no other kind.
As the rounds whizzed over their heads, Roby and Real moved forward as a team. They had a mission and a goal, and the sooner they got to it, the better, because the bullets would stop. Marks hung back since the op was designed for a two-person team, but she watched the pair closely for more than one reason. She marveled at how Real and Roby moved as a unit. They seemed to know what the other was thinking. In less than 20 minutes, they had achieved their goal, and Marks ordered the live fire to stand down. On the jeep ride back, Marks told them they had a visitor. "Who is it?" asked Roby.
"Someone you know, Will."
The jeep dropped them off about a mile from the facility and then drove on. A minute later, Blue Man stepped from behind a tree to greet them.
"You're both looking fit," said Blue Man. He was, as ever, dressed in a suit and tie with polished shoes.
He looked decidedly out of place in the forest. His hair was white, his features grizzled, but his eyes were light and alert, and his handshake strong. Real gave him a hug and whispered,
"Thank you,"
in his ear. Roby stared expectantly at Blue Man.
"I got a phone call from someone you've been interviewed by here," he began.
Roby and Real exchanged a glance. Real said,
"Male or female?"
Blue Man said,
"Male." He apologized for how late your session went and for the degree of wetness involved.
"Nice of him,"
said Real dryly.
"He also told me that there is a plan B in place in the event that your vetting here does not go well."
"And what is plan B?" asked Roby.
"The B team, actually, for the upcoming mission. You two are the preferred unit, of course."
"How flattering,"
commented Real.
"And do we know what the mission is?"
"One person at the agency knows, and that person is not me."
"Only one?" said Roby, looking startled.
"So Evan Tucker, then,"
suggested Real.
Blue Man nodded. "Highly unusual. I'm used to small circles of need to know, but a circle of one is problematic."
"We've survived so far,"
said Real.
"Do you see something coming up that might change that?"
"I won't mince words because that won't do either of you any good. The director is enormously conflicted at this point. Facts that I have gathered demonstrate a man perilously near the edge. He both needs you and wants to punish you. And it is unclear at this point which of these competing views will win out."
"He tried to waterboard us into a confession," said Roby. "That might indicate the punishment side is winning out." Blue Man nodded.
"First blush might indicate that, but it's unfortunately more complicated than that. He seems to be changing his mind not day by day, but hour by hour."
"And how do you know this?" asked Roby.
"We are an intelligence-gathering agency," replied Blue Man with a smile. "And there is no law against turning that skill inward."
Roby looked at Real.
"That may be why Tucker came calling here." "He came here to see you?" asked Blue Man.
Roby said, "He wanted to assure us that he has no personal vendetta against us and that everything they're throwing at us here, including the waterboarding, is part of the vetting."
"And did you believe him?" asked Blue Man.
"Hell no,"
snapped Real.
"And there are no assets we can call on to stop his vendetta against us?"
"That has been tried and his heels dug in. Personnel at the agency are convinced of the culpability of the former DD and the analyst. They were traitors pure and simple, and their deaths are not unduly troubling. Unfortunately, none of those people run the CIA.
"We understand that some deal has been struck with the president,"
said Real.
"That's the rub. This mission runs all the way to the White House. I've learned that there was a transmission at the sit room involving only the president, the DCI, and the APNSA.
Real looked confused.
"What about the watch command?"
"Walled off. First time in history, I believe. Literally no one other than the three men in that meeting was privy to who was on the other end of that satellite. Certainly a breach of normal protocol."
"So the VP wasn't there?" said Roby.
Blue Man shook his head.
Ominous, since the VP is normally part of the loop on something like that.
Wait a minute, do you think they're worried about transition exposure?
Said Real. Blue Man nodded. In case of impeachment, yes, that's exactly what I think. So they're walling off the VP so he could take over in case his boss gets the axe, said Roby. That tells us something.
High crimes and misdemeanors,
said Real.
That's what the Constitution says are impeachable offenses, but those words can be widely interpreted.
But in the intelligence world, something jumps out, said Roby.
Assassination of a head of state,
said Real. She looked sharply at Blue Man.
Is that what we're being dialed up to do?
I wish I could tell you for certain, but I can't. We hit Ahmadi before he came to power in Syria for that very reason, said Roby. He wasn't yet a head of state. Otherwise, it's illegal.
And bin Laden was a terrorist, not a head of state,
added Real. Blue Man considered all of this and then filled his chest with the invigorating mountain air. And there are a limited number of such targets for which the president would stick out his political neck. Very limited, said Roby. And it simply can't be some asshole dictator raping his country.
Saddam Hussein's fellow countrymen hung him, not us.
And Africa is not that important to us geopolitically. No basis to argue in the national interest.
I can actually think of two possible targets,
said Real.
And both of them are suicide missions for the people pulling the trigger.
She stared at Blue Man.
With no double cross needed. The target might go down, but so will the mission team. They might get in, but they won't get out. We're dead.
Blue Man said, Ergo, I believe that the director has resolved his conflict. But then again, that's what he thought last time. Chapter 21 Chung Cha had never met a Westerner who could tell the difference between a Chinese and a Japanese, much less a North Korean from a South Korean. This had proven very valuable to her work. To the world, North Koreans were evil, while South Koreans and Japanese caused no suspicions at all. And Chinese were tolerated because China made everything that everyone else used and had all the money, or so Chung Cha had been told.
She had taken a flight to Istanbul and boarded the train there.
She was now in Romania, heading west. She had been on a North Korean clunker, but never a train such as this. She had never seen anything so luxurious that moved. She was listening to music on her headphones as the train wended its way along. Chung Cha liked to listen to music because it allowed her mind to wander to other things. She could afford to let her mind drift now. Later, that would not be possible. The countryside here was quite remarkable. She enjoyed traveling by train for several reasons, not the least of which was the lessened standard of security. For this particular journey, there was another reason. That reason was residing in the same train car as she was, only four compartments down from her. She had seen him, but he had not seen her because he was not trained to observe, at least not at the level she was. The train's destination was Venice. From Istanbul, the trip took 6 days. She waited until he went to the dining car that night. Her gaze followed him all the way out of the sleeping car. She figured she had 30 minutes. She shouldn't need half that time. Chung Cha didn't simply kill people. She gathered intelligence. She looked like a shy young Asian woman who would pose a threat to no one. The fact that she could kill everyone on this train would not occur to any passenger. The man's compartment was locked. A few seconds later, it was no longer locked. Chung Cha slipped inside and shut the door behind her. She did not expect to find much. The man was a British envoy, lately attached to the embassy in Pyongyang. These types did not leave classified documents lying around in their empty train compartments. What secrets they did have were confined to their minds or on encrypted devices that would take an army of computers years to break into. But there were exceptions to that rule, and this man might prove to be one of those rare exceptions. It took her barely 15 minutes to efficiently search his compartment and leave no trace that she had done so. He had left, by her count, 6 subtle traps for those attempting to find something here.
Tripping any of them would reveal said search. She either didn't disturb them or returned them to their original positions, down to the millimeter. If he had a phone, he had taken it with him. There was no computer here. There were no documents of any kind. He was traveling very light. It must all be in his head. If it was, she could gain access to that as well. She knew many torture techniques, and for a very good reason. They had all been inflicted upon her at Yodok. She had been trained to be a snitch on her family in return for a reward, or sometimes simply so she wouldn't be beaten as badly. She had stolen food from her family. She had beaten others, some of them children. Her family had beaten her, snitched on her, stolen food from her. Children had beaten her, snitched on her, stolen food from her. That was just the way it was. Again, with enough fear, humans were capable of anything. She had always wanted to be one of the Boiwan children, the offspring of the guards. Their bloodlines had been affirmed by the great leader Il-Sung. They had food to eat and something softer than a concrete floor to sleep on. In her dreams, she had become a pureblood like them, with a full belly and perhaps a chance to pass through the electrified fence one day. And then one day, she had. The greatest day of her life. No prisoner had ever been released from Yodok's lifer zone. She had been the first. She was still the only one. She returned to her compartment, but she had left something back in the man's room. She heard him return a half hour later. The door opened and closed. She waited, listening through the wireless device mounted in her ear. In her mind, she followed his movements based on these sounds. She was not guessing. She was highly trained to be able to see with something other than her eyes. The movements were slow at first, routine, measured. Then they picked up a bit. Then they picked up pace even more. She knew exactly what that meant. There had been a seventh trap that she had overlooked. He knew his compartment had been searched. Perhaps he had also spotted the listening device she had planted there. She immediately checked the train schedule. 45 minutes from here. She had one small bag with her for the 6-day trip. She never carried much because Chung Cha had never had much. No more than would fit in a small bag. The car wasn't hers. The apartment wasn't hers. They could take it from her whenever they wanted. But what was in the bag was hers. 42 minutes later, the train slowed. Then it slowed some more. The conductor came on the PA and announced the next stop. She listened to the device. The man's compartment door opened and closed, and she could no longer hear anything from the device she'd planted in the room. However, she believed he would be heading to the right, away from her. The closest exit door was there. She opened the door to her compartment and sprinted to the left. She was out a service door and onto the station platform before the train even stopped. She took up position behind a stack of boxes and waited, peering through a crack in one of them. He got off and looked up and down the platform. He was waiting for someone else to get off, obviously the person who had searched his compartment. No one else did. He waited until the train started to pull away. Then he turned and hurried off without seeing her and entered the station. Her Asian appearance would be problematic for her now, she knew. There could not be many Asians in this ancient town of white Europeans. However, a hat and glasses helped hide her face. She started after him, keeping a good distance in between. He was already on his phone. Getting off the train had been an impromptu move, so he would need either lodging or ground transportation. If he opted for a car, she would have to strike fast. If lodging, she would have at least the night and morning to sort things out. She would prefer that. Fortunately for her, he picked lodging. She walked past where he entered and observed him through a window arranging for a room. He was still on the phone multitasking as he showed his passport and took the old-fashioned room key tied to what looked to be a large golden paperweight. It might come in handy, she thought. That paperweight.
Chung Cha sat in her room in the same hotel as the Brit. She sipped her hot tea and smacked her lips appreciatively. At Yodok, her gums had turned black and all her teeth had fallen out. What she had there now was the work of an orthodontist and the employee of the government. The worst of her scars had been hidden with plastic surgery, but the doctor had been unable to correct all of them. She didn't have enough undamaged skin left with which to do so. The burns had been the most painful. Being hung over a fire and made to confess something, anything, to make the pain stop, had not been good for one's complexion. So she sipped her tea, then touched her bed with the fat pillows and thick blanket. They felt nice to the touch, far better than what she had back in Pyongyang. She wondered whom he had called. Midnight passed to one. She heard a clock strike somewhere in the center of this ancient city. The sound of revelers died away a half hour later. That was when she was on the move. She did not walk down the hall. She went out the window. His room was three floors above hers, room 607, fourth over from the right. She had observed this through the hotel window when the key had been removed from its numbered cubby at the front desk. Finding small handholds, Chung Cha climbed swiftly. She opened the window to his room noiselessly and slipped inside. As soon as her foot hit the carpet, he was on her. Chung Cha felt the muzzle of the gun against her head, but before he could fire, she had spun away, placing her finger behind the trigger so he couldn't pull it. While he struggled with this, she used him as a fulcrum, leapt off her feet, spun her body around his, and slammed her knee into his right kidney. He screamed and dropped to his knees, his grip on the gun lessening, and she ripped it free. He tried to rise, but she whirled in front of him, rammed her foot into his crotch, and at the same time made a V with her elbow and crushed it against his temple. And then as he was toppling, she stabbed him in the shoulder with the knife she held in her left hand, his gun in her right. He lay on the floor holding his bleeding shoulder and gasping for air, his knees tucked involuntarily upward as the pain shot through his privates. He started to cry out, but she pounced and the rag was in his mouth, his shout stifled. He was a large man and she was a small woman. Though badly injured, he tried to rise. She struck him on the wound, and he fell back sobbing and holding his injured shoulder. She put his gun to his temple and told him what he must do or he would die now. He slowly rolled onto his belly. She tied him up securely, hands lashed to the ankles via a zip tie she had brought with her. She put him on his side and faced him, shining a light in his eyes. She spoke to him again in English. He nodded. She took the gag out and studied him. She asked him a question. He answered. She asked him four more questions. He answered only three. She put the gag back in his mouth and pushed her knife blade deeply into his wound. Without the gag, he would have woken the entire hotel with his cries of pain. She withdrew the blade and waited for him to calm. He looked at her, tears clustered in his eyes. She took out the gag and asked him the last question again. He shook his head. He snapped at her hand when she started to put the gag back in. He screamed, or tried to. She had already knocked him unconscious with the paperweight key she had spied on the nearby table. Blood poured down his face. She hurried to his nightstand and retrieved the phone there. She held it in her hand and looked down at the screen. She knew it was protected not by a password, but by a fingerprint scanner. She had seen him access his phone on the train once by doing this. She also reckoned that it would be sophisticated enough to recognize a living man's print versus a dead man's print. That was why she had not simply killed him. She pressed his pulsing thumb to the screen and unlocked the phone. She went into the phone's settings and disabled the auto lock and turned on the airplane mode. Now it was both open for good and also not traceable. She stooped down. The blade cut cleanly across his neck. She avoided the arterial spray when it came. She had become practiced at that. Back at Buckchang, she had not avoided it. She had wanted their blood, literally on her hands. She waited for a few moments, listening for sounds outside the room. She heard nothing. The walls in the ancient hotel must be very thick, she thought. She wiped the blood off her blade, rose, and hung a Do Not Disturb sign on the door. After that, she went through the various emails and contacts in the man's phone. She had been taught by captured South Koreans how to find ways into computer files, and she made ample use of this training. However, she didn't find much. She looked at the list of most recent phone calls. He had made two more from his room in addition to the one she had seen him making. Two she recognized by the country code as calls to England. The third was far more interesting. 850. That was the country code for North Korea. But it was not the number for the British embassy there, which she knew well. She swiftly calculated the time difference between where she was and North Korea.
It would be about 8:45 a.m. there. She turned off airplane mode and then hit the button to call this number.
The phone rang three times and then someone answered. Not in Korean, but in English. The voice spoke again. She listened until he stopped. And then Chung Cha hit the end call button. She left the room the way she had come, after quickly staging a robbery in the room. She took the phone, as well as the man's wallet, watch, passport, and ring. She had not unpacked her bag, so it was a simple thing to leave the hotel quickly and unnoticed, especially at that time of night. She proceeded to the train station in time to catch the next train that was rolling through. 10 minutes later, she was 5 miles from the town where she had just committed murder. 4 hours later, long before the body would be discovered, she had left that train and boarded a plane back to Turkey. Now she needed to decide what to do and how to do it. Chapter 22. Jessica Reel put down her weapon, slipped off her sound mufflers, and hit the button to draw the target toward her. 20 shots. 19 in the kill zone. 1 2-centimeters outside. She frowned. Not good enough. She had lost her focus on the 14th trigger pull. She looked at Roby next to her as his target sheet sailed toward him. All of his shots were in the kill zone. He looked at her errant shot mark.
I know,
she said miserably. She had easily passed the test on the firing range even by burner box standards. This was her first miss in over 2,000 fired rounds since they'd been here. Amanda Marks came to stand next to them.
I think you've proved your marksmanship still holds,
she said. They left the firing range and walked back to the main facility. The days here had been long and arduous, and Roby and Reel felt both exhausted and finely tuned.
2 possible targets,
said Reel suddenly. Marks and Roby slowed. Marks looked at her.
Blue man?
His visit was timely, said Roby.
It wasn't at my prompting,
said Marks.
We know,
replied Reel.
It apparently was your colleague. Viola, now there's a surprise. Not if he's feeling like a fish out of water. Word is he had a one-on-one with Tucker and came away more than a little nervous.
Hence the call to Blue Man, said Roby.
If Viola is nervous, something is off. 2 targets,
said Reel again.
2 possibilities.
They stopped walking altogether and stood in a tight circle.
2 heads of state, said Roby, after glancing at Reel. They had talked at length about how to break this to Marks. They had finally concluded that the direct way was best. Marks stared at him.
What the hell are you talking about?
The target will be a head of state, and the list of possibilities is pretty short.
The look of incredulity still in her eyes, Mark swallowed nervously and said,
Is that what Blue Man told you?
Roby said, Not directly, but circumstantially, the way this is stacking up, that's the only thing it could be. And he's in agreement with that assessment. That's what Tucker is putting together, and it's apparently eating him alive. That... and figuring out what to do with the two of us.
But that's illegal. Tucker would never go out on a limb like that.
He would, with appropriate alliances.
There are very few alliances that would justify that sort of mission,
said Marks, sharply.
And not all presidents are built the same,
noted Real. Marks stared at her for a long moment.
Are you saying what I think you're saying? Yes, I am. But that's an
impeachable offense, interjected Roby. That's why the need to know is so tight it's almost non-existent.
So Iran or North Korea?
Said Real.
Place your bets. Our two badass enemies. The remaining two of the old axis of evil. Now that Iraq is all nice and peaceful and full of terrorists.
Marks looked around. The area was deserted, but she still did not look comfortable discussing this. She said,
Clandestine ops like this are my whole wheelhouse as the DD. They're mine to direct, or not, and I know nothing about this.
Apparently, Tucker is the only one at CIA to know. Real added,
And the President, and Potter, the APNSA. This is crazy,
said Marks in a low voice.
How did Blue Man find this out?
By doing what Blue Man does better than anyone else, working his sources and reading the tea leaves and the faces of his superiors in the organization, said Roby. Tucker doesn't have the greatest poker face, and he didn't come up in the intelligence field. He's a politician. I'm sure Blue Man has ways to find out things at Langley that Tucker can't even imagine. Real said,
So Iran's president or the Ayatollah, or North Korea's supreme leader Un? This is absolutely insane,
said Marks firmly.
North Korea has nukes. Iran is close to having them. And they have death squads all over the world, including right here. If they're deployed in force with chemical or biological weapons?
Then we retaliate, and the Russians get involved, and then the Chinese, and Israel gets attacked, and we go to bat for them, said Roby.
Then it's all over,
said Real.
As in apocalyptic over.
Marks put a shaky hand to her face.
This can't be happening. If it is one of them, which?
Said Real. In some ways it doesn't matter, said Roby. We can get into Iran and North Korea maybe, but we won't be able to get out. Syria was hard enough, and Syria is not in the same league as those two. North Korea might as well be another planet. Mark said,
North Korea is another planet. But to get to that target, we have to have rock-solid inside people at the very top. How did that happen without my being aware of it? Intel like that doesn't occur overnight.
You haven't been on the job that long, said Roby. It might have happened before you got here. DiCarlo wasn't on the job long enough to see that through either.
That's true,
said Marks. But the DD before her, Jim Gelder, was, noted Roby. As he glanced at Real. Real looked away. She said,
Gelder could have been involved in something like that. He didn't just push the edges, he obliterated them. Taking down one of those guys, he would have seen it as his crowning glory, even if it did lead to Armageddon.
She paused and added,
He already tried something like that once. Guy's just full of surprises. Too bad he's dead. We might want to kill him all over again.
Roby looked at Marks. So how exactly does this go down? We're tasked to commit a hit on a target that is clearly illegal? How do we do that? I'm not going to be left holding the bag on something like that. Real said,
We've sat through our psych evals, and they keep pounding away at us on one thing. Will we follow orders, or will we make up our own? So you tell us, DD. What do we do if that order comes down?
Mark started to say something, but then stopped. Finally, she blurted out,